Okay, we're talking with A.C. Crispin, who is the author of the new Pirates of the Caribbean book, The Price of Freedom, which is a prequel set about when Jack Sparrow was about 25 years old and starting out in his career. And you've done a number of franchise tie-ins over the years, among them Star Trek, Star Wars with the Han Solo trilogy. Over the years, it seems the process with the franchise tie-in has changed a lot. Talking with people like John Ordover and Kevin Dillmore, Dayton Ward, it's not the same as it was when you submitted Yesterday's Son. How has that process changed?
Well, when I submitted Yesterday's Son, I didn't have an agent, and they were looking, they would read. If you wrote a Star Trek book, you could actually submit it to Pocket Books. You didn't need an agent, and they would at least give it a read, and they bought a number of books from fans. And I guess I would be considered one of them, who that was, you know, one of their first efforts, and they bought Star Trek books from them if they liked them well enough. These days, you really can't submit to a franchise pretty much unless you're invited. Or you have a, you know, a fairly, you know, well-known agent or something of that sort. Franchise writing is not something that people can just, you know, try to jump into and get it, you know, get it looked at. With Star Wars, if you send your book in, they won't look at it. They won't even open it. They don't want to see them unless they have contacted you and asked you to write something, and then, you know, through your agent or whatever, and you're writing it under contract, and that's the only way they want to see Star Wars. And it's been a long time since I've done a Star Trek. I'm not sure what the rules are, but they're probably on, you know, Simon Schuster's website, and I'm pretty sure that they're pretty much buying books from authors they've used before, as opposed to letting fans send things in. I'm pretty sure they don't do that anymore.
Now, with the Pirates of the Caribbean deal, when they approached you, are they coming to you as a genre writer that they want to work with, or are they looking at your track record at doing franchise tie-in books and saying, okay, you know how it works, you know what the process is? Does that make it easier for them to come to you and do a franchise book?
Doing a Pirates of the Caribbean original novel. In other words, a book that was not based on any of the movies. It's not a movie novelization or anything of the sort. It's the book that came basically 13, 14 years before the events of Curse of the Black Pearl. And about, you know, Jack Sparrow becoming Captain Jack Sparrow is really what it is. And I was told that what the editor did was think about the project when she got permission to commission a writer. And she thought, well, who in the industry has done, what character in the industry is anything like Jack Sparrow that somebody might have written about? And she went, aha, lovable rogue, loves his ship, humor, and Han Solo popped into her head. They don't talk anything alike, but they're both kind of lovable rogues, and sometimes portrayed, at least in the first Star Wars movie, and throughout for Jack as in Shades of Grey rather than, you know, hero characters, and so that's how so then the editor looked up all the Star Wars books that were concentrating on Han, and so she read them all, or at least read around in them, and found the ones she liked the best, and it was my Han Solo trilogy. So she said, aha, this woman has a good track record, and I think she handled Han the best. So that's when they called my agent to see if I was available.
One of the things that I have admired about your writing, especially with the franchise books, is your ability to get the characters' voices so accurately. A lot of times when you're reading a Star Trek book or a Star Wars book, that the author doesn't, you can tell they know the material, but they don't quite get the voices right. And I don't know if there's a particular method to doing that better than others, but how do you go about making sure that if you're working with established characters, they actually sound like those characters?
Well, I think in my case, I must have an ear for it, I guess, an ear for their dialogue and speech patterns and all that sort of thing, because I've always been able to kind of mimic speech patterns pretty well. But to me, you know, when I used to write Star Trek fanzine type stuff, which never saw the light of day, thank you very much, people would say, oh, that sounds just like Mr. Spock. And I've listened to those characters, and I watched the shows over and over and over again in the case of Star Trek and Star Wars. Certainly when I was commissioned to do work, I had a reason to do it, I watched the shows over and over and over again. I you know, paid attention to how those characters looked and how they spoke, and in my mind I was kind of trying them on for size, putting myself inside them and listening to how they talked. And Jack was a big challenge because he doesn't talk like anybody else. Jack is, you know, he's fond of his speech and his speech patterns. He's fond of obfuscating and making wacky Latin quotes and saying the opposite from what he really means and saying something that's completely, you know, 180 degrees away from anything else, and then doing a 360-degree turn and telling you the perfect truth and making it sound like the biggest lie you ever heard. You know, that's just Jack. He's really convoluted in his logic and his speech patterns, and that kind of ability to be to obfuscate and be convoluted and all in his speech is as much of a weapon as his pistol or his sword, especially when it comes to confounding and confusing other men. Ladies see through Jack more, I think. Elizabeth sure did, I think Angelica does too, and having now seen on Stranger Tides. But other men, Jack, you know, will talk to the, like, it's like those two, you know, Murtagh and Mulroy, the two dumb Marines regarding the interceptor. He tells them exactly what he's going to do, and one of them does get it. He's not as dim as the other one. And then he proceeds to tie them in verbal knots until Elizabeth falls off the cliff, kind of, you know, and he gets them totally confused, and he's on the ship, and he's checking out the layout, and they're, like, arguing with each other. He can do this brilliantly. The other thing is that, you know, people talk about, they asked Johnny Depp when they, you know, some of the Disney executives and things said, oh my God, is the character gay? What? Why is he swishing? Why is he, you know, waving his hands in the air and talking in a sort of fey way? And no, character isn't gay. At least nobody ever told me he was, and I didn't pick up on that. I pick up on Jack as being very much of a ladies' man, but he understands that normal red-blooded macho guys are completely confounded when if he twitches his butt at them, you know, if he swishes a little, their brains come out the window. They're like, what is he doing? And they stop thinking, and they don't figure him out, and then he's put one over on them.
Right. Now, his characteristic of obfuscation and doublespeak and all that, how much of a challenge does that present to you in plotting the story out? Because you have to have everything figured out from you know, page one all the way to the end, what Jack's going to do. And then do you plan that out and then figure out where the doublespeak is going to land? Or is this all just organic as part of the process and you just see where it falls into the story?
About the first third of the book, the first 100 to 200 pages, I was planning, and I was trying things on to see if they'd work right. And then, at that point, something clicked, and it became very organic. And that's just the way, that was just Jack, and I was Jack when I was writing him, from his point of view. And I didn't have to agonize so much about it. I'll tell you when it clicked for me was in the, I think it's the second chapter. There's a scene where Jack is talking to his crew on the Fair Wind, and, you know, he's worried about the crew, that they'll try to attack the pirate ship, the Venganza, and they'll all get killed, because he knows it's crewed by fierce, bloodthirsty pirates, and the pirate lord of the Caribbean is a woman from his past, Esmeralda, and she's nothing like Angelica, nothing, except that they're both Hispanic. And I, Esmeralda, by the way, I'm going on record, was created several years before Angelica was. It's just a coincidence. I'm not copying anybody, and I don't think they were copying me either. It's just coincidence. There were a lot of Spanish pirates, what can you say?
Sure.
Anyway, so Jack has a little speech he gives to them, and something about, in the course of writing that speech, he says, they're all afraid that these are rogue pirates and they will all be murdered, because rogue pirates fly a flag of no quarter, and even if you surrender, they kill you anyway. This is why they're rogues. They're breaking the code.
Right.
And Jack is talking to the crew, and he's trying to say, okay, we're not going to fight. We're not going to resist. All they will do is take our cargo. These are just regular pirates. They are not rogue pirates. And, you know, trust me on this. You know me, lads. You know me, mates. I'm, you know, Jack Sparrow, and I sail a straight weight. You know, and he says, look at that flag. He says, that is, what color is that flag? And somebody says, it's black. He says, that's right. It is truly a flag of the noir nature. And he goes on, and he talks about this black flag and how the rogue pirates fly a red flag with the horned demon on it, and that is not a, you know, so the difference between red and black, and these, you know, superstitious, terrified crewmen, you know, he gets them to sit down on the deck and give up their arms, and he's trying to save their lives, and so they won't resist, and all they'll do is take the cargo, and yes, we'll be lighter on the cargo, but we'll be alive. And so Jack is trying to save his crew, which as a merchant first mate, whose captain is rather incompetent and drunk, he really feels a responsibility to do, because he's honestly trying to make it as a merchant seaman. And when I hit that speech, and I came to the part about the flag of a noir nature, that sounded so Jack-like, I was like, I'm catching him, that's it, and I could just hear him from that point on. It was Johnny Depp's voice in my head.
And that's when it all started to click. Now, when that happened, did you have to go back to the first sections?
Oh, yes, I did considerable rewriting in the beginning to tighten and edit and tear down and things like that. Most books certainly can be tightened, and I probably lost 50 pages out of the first 200 or so, just by cutting things here and there to tighten the book up. Yeah, and that kind of thing is almost always necessary. There are very few books that couldn't benefit from being tightened and edited. I hope I've never become one of those writers that doesn't pay any attention to editors and get so famous that nobody edits them anymore. That would be bad.
Talking about the editing process and the revisions, how much of a free hand did you get from Disney? When you posted that the book was done on your Facebook, you mentioned that it took 3 years to do this. And
It did take me 3 years to write, but it took me at least 6 months worth of research before I was ready to start writing. And by that time, the contract had been issued and things like that, and I could start writing. And then there was quite a bit of time going back and forth until Disney hit an outline that they liked. We're talking about the film liaison type people, studio, you know, liaison folks, before they hit a plot that they would approve. I wrote several plot lines, and so I actually have several such stories that I could write. And they were very thorough plot lines, too. And the last one, it was like, okay, this is the one we want. And so I was like, okay, I'll do that one. And that took close to a year. And the book, them writing the book itself took about 15, 16 months.
Now, once you have your plot done and approved, are you working from an outline at that point, or it's...
Oh, yeah,
it's...
a very thorough outline. I had an outline that was about 78 single-spaced pages.
And some of the other plots, are they going to show up as books, or were they all tossed out and you've got to start over?
I have no idea. I believe, you know, this is a Singleton standalone book, as far as I know. If it did very well, Disney might be interested. I mean, you know, that's the case. Nobody's told me anything like that. But if you write a book and it does very well, you know, the publisher may come back to you and ask you for more, but nobody's mentioned anything like that to me. So I think they're waiting to see how it does.
Are they gauging any of this based on your track record as an author, or they're just wanting to see how this book does as a standalone Pirates of the Caribbean?
Oh, I'm sure they're gauging it just how it does, how the sales figures shake out. Of course, this is one of the first times they've really done a novel, and full-length for adults novel. So this is sort of new for Disney Editions too. And of course, there are electronic. There's electronic edition, Kindle and Nook, and that's, you know, Disney hasn't been into electronic stuff all that long. So I think that there's, you know, they'll be looking at a lot of things.
So they're really in uncharted waters, as it were.
Yeah, really. Yeah. It's the first book, and you know, I'm sure they're looking at it, going, well, how is it going to do? Mm-hmm. And nobody knows yet, obviously.
Now, as part of your research, you're having to put fictional characters in historical settings, the East India Trading Company being one.
Of course, the Pirates of the Caribbean universe, and they make this very clear to you. They give you this giant book called The Pirates of Mythology, and it has all the stuff that was observed in the films. It had all been written up, and there's little bios of all the characters, no matter how obscure. There's like a little bio for Cotton and the Parrot, you know. All the different kinds of ships and maps and some history and that kind of thing. So they did give me a pretty free hand in creating a story, but I had to write to a certain point, which was basically right to the point where Jack is, we're going to be able to recognize him. That this is the seeds of the Jack we see about 13 or 14 years later. And so I was like, okay. And there was a very specific point that they, you know, told me to write towards. So I knew I had to get the character to that point. But what happened in between, I had a very free hand in creating. I mean, you know, deciding on what fantasy elements to put in, what who the other characters would be, things like that. And what the intrigue would be, what the dramatic tension would be. And I did say to them, look, Jack is a merchant seaman, and this is taking place off the coast of Africa, a lot of it. And so it's a Pirates of the Caribbean book, so we got to put some pirates, and we got to put the Caribbean in there somewhere, hello, where readers won't be happy. And they said, yes, that's true. So why don't you create some flashbacks to Jack's life in Shipwreck Cove? So I put Jack's life in Shipwreck Cove in flashback form, when he's 20, and both storylines, there's two parallel storylines, one when he's 20, one when he's 25, and everything from both of them gets resolved when he's 25, the character, both plot lines.
Now, how much, you mentioned the, I guess you could call it a show Bible that you were given from Disney, how much world building were you actually able to do?
I had to do... What they told me was be historically and nautically accurate where it doesn't conflict with Disney Pirates of the Caribbean canon. And we do know it's an alternate universe. For example, Port Royal is there. Port Royal was actually historically destroyed in 1692 by an earthquake. So it didn't exist in the 1800s, the early 1700s, which is pretty much when... nobody has a definite year that Pirates of the Caribbean starts out, and so I just kind of shut my eyes and went, okay, early 1700s, and built my research to reflect that. So yes, the book is indeed historically and nautically accurate. In other words, if Jack gives an order as to how he wants sails for a certain kind of wind, or a storm is coming up and they have to do something, you know, reef the canvas and all. And all of that is real stuff. I'm certainly not Patrick O'Brien, but I made a point of getting nautical assistance from experts and found out how you actually sail a square rigger and everything. I actually went out and sailed on some of those antique vessels.
That must have been just terrible. having to go out and do that kind of research.
Reading all those books was a challenge. And I didn't write a single scene in that book except for one. Just one scene where I didn't have to look something up.
Did you read any Horatio Hornblower as part of your research?
I've read all the Hornblower books before, but I read them all again, yes. Oh.
Now, how does this one compare in terms of the world building with the other franchise books that you've done? You're basically starting from scratch with this one.
It was tougher.
Was it?
Much tougher. Much, much tougher because you have a real world that you're working from. And I don't care how detailed Star Trek is. I don't care how detailed Star Wars is. And they're very detailed universes. They're very well built at this point, and they... You know, they have planets, they're people with all this kind of stuff, but still, they are man-made. They are created. And if you read the books and you study this, you can get pretty familiar. But how am I supposed to know everything that went on in the early 1700s? That's a big challenge. Just how people lived their lives, the minutiae of their lives, to make it seem completely real. And sailing a ship. And how to navigate, all that stuff. When you have Han Solo there, he enters his commands into the nav computer, and then he sets his course. But you don't have to say how he does it, right? You just say he did it.
Now, is it?
You have to actually know how they set a course, and how they did a chip log, and all that stuff. Now, I didn't burden the reader with too much of this, but I had to be able to include enough details to have verisimilitude.
Sure.
So, yeah, our world is much bigger than those other worlds.
Now,
it's a real world, and even though it's an alternate universe, it's very close to our world.
How does that compare to the world building you do for your original stuff like Starbridge?
Starbridge, I made up a ton of stuff, and I have a very extensive Bible. It's like 100 pages. But still, and I added into it, as I created more things. But it's still not a real world. This was a real world. And so, you know, it's very big. And even though Jack says, well, yeah, the world's just still as big, there's just not as much in it. Well, there was plenty in it for one writer who had to try to figure it all out and figure out how it was going to work. You know, I had to find out, what did people wear under their clothes? Their outer clothes. Where was how were the captain's cabin configured? Where did the officers sleep? You know, what was on the orlop deck? What did they balance the ship? Well, giant stones down the bilges, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, more stuff than I ever would have figured. I spent a lot of time prowling around on antique ships.
Collaborating versus writing solo. You've collaborated with a number of people, Andre Norton being one, Howard Weinstein with the V books.
Uh-huh.
Is it easier, harder, or just different to do a collaboration?
It's different. It's different. Each person has got to give 110% to have a good collaboration. It's not really that much easier, but in some ways it's more fun because there is somebody that cares just as much as you do as to whether the book is good that you can always call up and brainstorm with. Whereas, you know, you're kind of brainstorming with yourself when you're writing solo. I mean, you brainstorm with your fellow writers and stuff. And I'm sure my beta readers were very helpful, but essentially you're talking to yourself most of the time. Or your cat. I wrote a blog post recently. I've started a blog. And I wrote the obligatory thank you to my writing familiar, my cat. And he gets to hear all the mumbled dialogue and everything like that. And every so often, he'll actually turn his head and look at the screen and go, wow.
Well, I do believe Robert A. Heinlein had a cat, so I think you're in good company there.
Yeah, a lot of writers have writing familiars that are cats because they're relatively quiet. They nap a lot, and they're there if you want to pat them, and they don't really need to be taken out and walked and stuff.
You mentioned doing Star Trek and Star Wars. You haven't done Star Trek in a while. Are there any possibilities of you returning to any of those worlds at any point in the future?
You know, I like to think that there's always possibilities, as they said in Star Trek. But I haven't been asked about it, and really have no plans to go back. If I were contacted, I'd certainly take it under consideration. Try not to slam doors and burn bridges in this business. You
sure.
have to stay open and flexible. But no immediate plans. The next book I will be working on will be a YAFF, and it will be an original book.
Okay. Any chance of going back?
Only 90,000 words long. Yay. 240,000 words long.
Yeah.
That's a long book.
Any chance of another Starbridge book anytime?
Well, people have asked me about that, and I guess at this point my main concern with Starbridge would be I'd like to try to get the books put onto the Kindle and made available to the Kindle. People have asked me about it. A lot of people have actually come and asked me about it, and that is something that I guess I'll pay attention to once I'm done with promotion for The Price of Freedom and gotten a really good start on my YA. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll turn my attention to finding out what it takes to get books onto Kindle. This is not something that, I've ever had any experience with, so it would be a learning curve for me.
Has the electronic, the e-reader stuff, how much of that, how much of a game changer do you think that has become in publishing?
Oh, it's growing by leaps and bounds. And I mean, for years, people have been saying, print is dead. So, I don't know. I'm going to the BEA in just a couple of days, and I think there'll probably be a lot of print books around. So I don't think print is dead, but I think that the industry is clearly changing. Mm-hmm. And I think that the publishing industry is going to have to figure out a way, and consumers will have to figure out a way. They say things like, there's books pirated and everything. They say information wants to be free. Well, entertainment wants and needs to be paid. So there's got to be some way for authors still to be able to make a living, and we worry about that. I mean, in some cases, people are saying, oh, you should just write for the joy of it. Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I really think the authors that can entertain you pretty effectively deserve just as much as actors or singers or something to be paid. So we'll see how that all works. It's going to be new, and in 5 years, I don't think we'll recognize. 5 years ago, we wouldn't have been able to predict the way things are today, and 5 years from now, I doubt we can predict what things will be like. I think we're just going to have to do the best we can.
Just from talking with editors and your own involvement with the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, are you seeing a trend where electronic publishing is making it easier for self-publishing? Are the two going hand in hand, do you think, or one feeding the other?
To some extent, yes. But what people don't understand is that some people may not understand is there is still value in being. In other words, if you write a book and you're convinced your book is just as good as anything that was ever published professionally, and you take your book and you put it out there for Kindle, and you have a POD edition from a print-on-demand publisher, people do these things, and then they're astonished that they don't take off and become big bestsellers the way their favorite, the way the next Stephen King book will be or something, because they think, I'm just as good. But they may or may not have actually had a really good editor work on it, And it's very hard to judge and evaluate your own work. And most of those books, the self-published or indie books, are rarely edited professionally. And I think that's where a lot of problems come in. You can't underestimate the value of a good editor and having another eye on your book. And I don't mean just proofreading stuff, although that's important. It gets very annoying to read a book where there's typo after typo. But in addition, real editors, they go through your work and they go, I believe the characterization needs some fleshing out here. Or, I didn't understand this motivation here. And they help you, you know, isolate the problems and so you can fix them. And it's true that authors, like, you know, myself, for example, on my second or third read-through of something, I'll spot things that I never saw before, and I'll fix them. And so will my editor. He'll spot things that, you know, you keep fixing things up until they say, you know, that's it, it's gone. And, but I don't think most of the print-on-demand books go through anything like the process that a commercially published book goes through, insofar as having other eyes on it to try to look at it from the standpoint of what's the best this story can be.
Well, not to mention the marketing aspects of it.
Yes, having
the resources to promote it.
Has become, you know, the author has to do so much more than they ever used to do. This is the first book I've ever really worked on promoing in my whole life.
Really?
Yes.
Now, I've
done book signings and stuff like that.
And you hit the conventions.
For years I've taught workshops, and I'm sure that's a form of promotion. But, you know, insofar as going out there and putting excerpts in various places and, you know, blogging and making sure I have a footprint on the internet with this book, no, nothing like that. Never did anything like that before.
And you're going to be doing a writing workshop coming up at Dragon Con.
Actually, I'm doing two advanced workshops, yes, on Thursday and Friday. And the descriptions are up on the Dragon Con website. It's, www.dragoncon.org.
And what other appearances are you going to be making between now and then?
Renovation, which is the World Science Fiction Convention in Reno. And I'm planning to be at Shortleaf. And I will be at Balticon next week. And there actually will be a launch party. And if anybody's coming to Balticon, they should come to my launch party. It's open to the public. It will be at 6 o'clock on the evening of the 28th of May.
Okay.
At the Hunt Valley Marriott at Balticon.
And your website is accrispin.com. You're on Facebook,
right.
Twitter. Where else can we find you on the internet? Facebook, Twitter, your site?
I have an AC Crispin author page on Facebook, and then I'm Ann Crispin on my personal page. I kind of go back and forth between the two of those. I post the writing stuff on my AC Crispin page. I post basic writing tips and information from Writer Beware and things like that on the actual author site.
Now, how is Writer Beware holding up? That's been going on for quite a while now, hasn't it?
About 12 years, 13 years. It really started in 1998. So it's been quite a while, yeah.
And is that still as much work as it was starting out? You're still getting as many scams that you're finding out there, or has it eased up, or has it gotten worse?
It's like playing whack-a-mole. you get a couple of them and you put them out of business, or you know, the word gets out on them, and they disappear, and then they pop up someplace else under a different name. Unless, in a few cases, you know, the authorities have gotten them. And that doesn't happen often, as far as I'm concerned. But we do the best we can to bring them to people's awareness. And so people, aspiring authors who are interested in getting a real agent or finding a real publisher, should go and look up Writer Beware, which is www.writerbeware.com. And on the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America site, and read up on how to, you know, tell which of the agents out there are real, which of the publishers out there are real, as opposed to con artists who are out there trying to get your money.
And speaking of conners, Jack Sparrow is one that we don't want to avoid.
No, and, you know, Jack is kind of, you know, one of those lovable scoundrels, you know?
Right. Pirates of the Caribbean: The Price of Freedom is out now. It's in print. It's you said Kindle, Nook. Is it available in any other electronic form?
I don't know.
Okay.
I've just heard about the Nook and the Kindle. It's available on Amazon.com for Amazon and BNN on .com had a price war on my book. And so it's available on both sites, online sites, for $13.08 right now.
Wow.
It is not available in Barnes & Noble stores, which is too bad. You can't get it at Barnes & Noble. I don't know about Borders. Borders is kind of like not acquiring very much in the way of stock. I have heard that it's in Books a Million, which is good. And then there's independent bookstores that are carrying it. And let's see. That's about all I can think of, and I really hope that people will enjoy it. And I do have a blog. They can come tell me what they liked about it, what they didn't, and things like that on the blog. And there's a link to my blog right on my website.
Okay. Well, Ann Crispin, thanks very much for your time today. We wish you much continued success. Good luck with the book. Hopefully, it's the first of many, and we'll pick up a copy as soon as we can get out to the bookstore.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Jason.
Okay, thanks very much for your time today.
Okay.